Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of December, and it's all things political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock. Our guests, two of them this hour, Dan Balls, author of Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. He's chief correspondent at the Washington Post, former national editor, political editor, White House correspondent. Molly Ball will join us later in the hour. Molly is a staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. Some of the issues this hour, Molly says the broad approval of the budget deal demonstrated a few things. First, it showed the enormous credibility Paul Ryan has with his colleagues. In writing about Boehner's blasts at outside groups calling for the defeat of the bipartisan budget before it was unveiled, Dan asks whether this will be a truly crystallizing moment for a party still trying to find its way after its defeat in 2012. We'll discuss economic inequality, the president saying he would spend much of his remaining time in office on this issue. How much can or will he do about it? Obamacare is blamed for higher costs, and you can never be too ready for Hillary. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour for all things political. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dan Balls is our first guest. He's author of Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. He's chief correspondent at the Washington Post, former national editor, political editor, White House correspondent, also author of The Battle for America 2008 and Storming the Gates. He's a regular panelist on PBS's Washington Week and MSNBC's The Daily Rundown. Dan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you with us. Well, let's start with Boehner's comments about these outside groups. Is this an indication that the Tea Party is on the wane here, or is it an indication of something else? Why did he take them on so vociferously?
Well, he was very unhappy, particularly that some of these outside groups, the Heritage Action Fund and others, opposed the budget deal even before the budget deal was unveiled. And he had a lot of respect and admiration for what Paul Ryan had done, and he was unhappy that people were taking potshots at him, and as explained to me, this was more spontaneous than planned. Having said that, I don't think it's a moment that says the Tea Party is badly in retreat or in the wane. I think what it does say is that the sort of the establishment side of the Republican Party at this point is fed up with some of the tactics that the Tea Party movement has been using, and particularly the outside groups, and that their goal is to push back in a more significant and concerted way than they've done in the past.
What about the money? We've been hearing, Dan, so often that the outside groups fueling primary challenges have a whole lot of money. The Tea Party thus has a whole lot of influence, and you have to be very careful what positions you take if you're a Republican who's running for reelection.
Well, I think that is certainly reality. I think that Republicans in the House have a greater fear about having a primary and being challenged from the right with someone who's got Tea Party support and support from some of these outside groups financially than they worry about their general election races, because most are in pretty safe districts, as are Democrats. But the idea that there is, an outside set of forces who are kind of looking over their shoulder at everything makes them nervous, and so they have tried to in a sense toe the line. And we saw on the vote in the House on the budget last week there were about 60 Republicans who opposed that agreement. This is a minority of the Republican caucus, but in fact it is a sign of the size of the group that in essence forced the shutdown last October on the party. And so that dynamic is very real.
You covered very carefully the 2012 campaign. The talk after that campaign was the Republicans need to figure out how to re-identify themselves because they've got midterms coming up and they have a presidential election, and the party just doesn't know where it is on certain issues. They need to reach out to minorities, et cetera. What kind of soul-searching has the Republican Party done, do you think, Dan?
Well, they've done a fair amount. How much it has changed the party, I think, is a different question. And the truth is that they've got a bigger problem when they look to 2016 than when they look to 2014. The midterm elections could be pretty good for Republicans. They have an opportunity to take control of the Senate. They have to win a number of races, and they have to knock off several incumbent Democratic senators. But many of those races tend to be in red states where, you know, the Republicans have hopes of being able to win them. Their bigger problem on the national front is exactly as you described it, that their poor performance among Hispanics in 2012. I don't think we're going to see much change at all in the vote of African Americans going forward, but the Republicans have got to do much, much better on that front. And, you know, we come to the end of 2013, and as you look back, in some ways, the party is not grappling with that issue, at least as a whole, as much as it was at this time a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem for the Democrats running would still be health care?
Oh, absolutely, yes. The combination of the dissatisfaction with the Affordable Care Act and the president's low approval ratings. I mean, he's had a very bad fall, and I use that term advisedly, a very bad autumn, which has resulted in a fall in his approval ratings. So Democrats, you know, he's not on the ballot next year, but if the president is at 40 or 41% in the polls on his approval rating, that's going to be a stiff headwind for Democrats running in congressional and Senate competitive races.
And what can he do to boost his approval ratings?
Well, I would say there are several things. One is that they can try to turn around perceptions of the Affordable Care Act. It obviously had a terrible rollout in October and November. The website, they say, is working better, but it's not clear that public perceptions of the law have changed dramatically. So that's one problem. And that the whole issue of the Affordable Care Act is one that still, I think, is likely to energize Republican voters more than Democratic voters next year. And in midterm elections, turnout is obviously always an important factor. The second thing he can do is continue to hope and do whatever he can for improvement in the economy. I mean, more than anything, you know, people's perceptions of the economy shape political attitudes when people go to the ballot box. And there are some signs of recovery, certainly, but most people don't feel it and don't feel that the economy is really turning around. And so he needs more help on that front. To the extent he can do anything about that, I think is more questionable, because they've struggled for now 5 years, and they still have a long way to go. And the third, I think, is that he has to find a way to kind of reconnect with people to boost up public perceptions of his leadership, of his truthfulness. I mean, all of that has taken a beating over the last several months, and, he's got an opportunity when the new year starts to try to not start fresh, but to try to deal with that. And so I think he has to try to do all of those things.
You wrote a very thorough piece about his speech on income inequality and asked whether or not he can or will do anything about it. My first question is, why did he return to that theme, which has been one of his themes going way back to 2004?
Well, I think that it is something that he has always talked about, long talked about, regularly talked about. And I think in the middle of all this healthcare problem that he was having, he and his team did not want that issue, both the broad issue of the economy and a central issue related to that of rising income inequality, to be lost. And so he has returned to that subject from time to time, partly in an effort to remind people that he's thinking about it and caring about it and trying to do something about it. And I think partly because he sees this as an issue of significance for the country. I mean, there's no question that income inequality is a problem for the country as a whole, and I think he wants to force a bigger debate about it. And, as I wrote in that piece, the question is, how much can he actually do? You know, it's hard to take any significant steps to do much, but there may be some small things he can do, and I think we'll perhaps hear and see more of that when he does his State of the Union address in late January.
Mm-hmm. You also asked the question, and I'm interested in your response, are the issues of economic insecurity and inequality centrally important to voters?
Well, if you ask voters about it, yes. I think voters do care about it, and I think they think that things should be done about it. Beyond raising the minimum wage, which has always been pretty popular, I don't know exactly what people would sign off on in terms of that. I suspect the other thing that they would favor, because they long have, is to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans. So I don't think that this issue has ever been debated fully in a presidential campaign. It certainly wasn't. I mean, it was mentioned in the 2012 campaign, but it wasn't as though it was debated in a significant way. And by that, I mean with a kind of a full set of choices that people would have before them as to what that exactly meant. I mean, in the abstract, I think people think that it's not healthy for the country to have the kind of gap we now have between the very richest and in a sense almost everybody else, but particularly the lowest and second lowest quintiles in our society. But what are the policies that one side or the other would advocate, and where do people come down on that? It's another question.
Mm-hmm. You, in your book, your history of the 2012 campaign, I'd like for you to tell us this story, this post-election interview you had with Mitt Romney, when you brought up his 47% remark. Can you relay that conversation, and then let me ask you another question about...
Sure. When I raised that with him, we were discussing it, and I said at one point, you had said that this 47% of the public would never take personal responsibility for their own lives. And he immediately protested and said, I did not say that. And he got up and he grabbed his iPad and went through some notes that he had made about that episode. The truth is that he had said that. It was in the transcript. It was in the video that was released by Mother Jones. And I think that I came away with that from that moment, thinking that Governor Romney did not want to believe he had actually said that, that he did not want to believe that those words actually reflected his own true feelings. And so I think in some ways he was trying to deny reality on that front. And it was that interview took place in late January of this year, so it was several months after the election, but it was a reminder that he was still kind of coming to terms with what had happened in the election. He obviously knew, Kathleen, that this was a bad moment for him when that video was released, that it kind of crystallized this perception that he was, you know, wealthy and out of touch with ordinary people. But I think he was still grappling with the question of what it really said about him and what he could do to kind of, you know, allay those perceptions.
And can you extend that to the Republicans or some Republicans now, or is that just an issue that was peculiar to Romney, that many Republicans are out of touch, that they speak to the wealthy, or is that not with us anymore, that issue?
Well, I think that the issue was particularly a problem for Governor Romney because of his own personal biography and situation.
Yeah, he had a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, he may have been the wealthiest person who ever, you know, was at the top of a ticket. Certainly in the modern era, he had more net wealth than anybody who's been running. More than, I think, John F. Kennedy. More by far than the Bushes. So there was that particular issue. Now, you know, I think Republicans more than Democrats have been seen as a party that is more favored, whose policies are more favorable to the rich. The reality is, though, among a lot of white voters, they get a very good share of middle and lower middle income white voters. So voting patterns are a little bit different than the perceptions of the two parties, but because Republicans have favored tax cuts that have disproportionately helped the wealthy, there's that perception that still sticks with the party. But Governor Romney had a had that problem and more because of his own personal situation.
We're going to welcome a few phone calls for Dan. Dan Balls is our guest this hour. Dan is the author of Collision, 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. Chief correspondent at the Washington Post, he is former national editor, political editor, White House correspondent, author of a number of other books as well. And we're doing all things political this hour. Feel free to comment on the issues that we have talked about, the budget that passed and what it says about the divisions within the Republican Party and what those divisions say about midterm elections and the 2016 presidential campaign. Our next guest will say that it really shows the strength of Paul Ryan. Would you agree that he was really front and center on coming up with, along with Patty Murray, a compromise here? The president deciding that he wants to make this issue, he's talked about it before, of income inequality, the defining challenge of our time, and will spend much of his remaining time in office on that particular issue. Do you think that's a good issue? We would agree that there's a problem here, but when it comes to policy, we got a lot of different debates. What about the Affordable Care Act? There is news over the weekend that people are complaining about increases in their premiums due to the Affordable Care Act. And whatever else you'd like to bring up, time is short with Dan, so call in now if you'd like to, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to a couple of phone calls for Dan. Wendy in Oconomowoc, our first caller. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I have a question about the Affordable Care Act. I don't know exactly what's happening with this, but we are in the independent market and having a hard time getting health care in the past and all sorts of problems, which I won't go into. So we were very happy about the Affordable Care Act. However, when we first looked at the rates on the website, they were actually a couple hundred dollars less and covered more than what we were paying before. But now we just went on again, and the rates have, in some ways, almost gone up by another third in the past few weeks, just in like the last 2 weeks. And I'm wondering, now I know we have the private health insurance companies still involved, which is probably the reason for this, but I'm just wondering why now suddenly in the last few weeks the prices have gone up so dramatically.
Do you know, Dan?
I don't know the answer to that, but I will pass that on to the people on our staff who are covering this quite closely and ask them if they have heard anything similar to that. It's the first I've heard of prices going up in this period in which the enrollment process has been open. But if that's so, I don't know whether it's an anomaly or whether there are more examples of that. But I'll ask our folks to take a look.
Thanks, Wendy, for the call. Jennifer in Cassville. Hi.
Hi. How are you today?
All right, Jennifer.
The reason I'm calling is because he seems to be in the know about how Congress is working. And with the change in, I would call it gerrymandering districts, what kind of effect does he think that will have on Congress on the 2014 election?
Well, I think that gerrymandering is one factor in what I would call the broader reality of polarization in this country. The truth is that congressional districts on both sides are safer today than they once were. There are fewer competitive districts. And the other reality is that because of the way of where people live and the way the lines are now drawn, Republicans have a small built-in advantage to keep control of the House of Representatives. In 2012, Democrats actually won more popular votes in the all House races combined across the country, but obviously are in the minority. So the Republicans have, as I say, some advantage heading into 2014 to be able to hold their majority and possibly expand it if the president's in deep trouble with the public.
And thanks very much for the call. I need to ask you before we let you go about the budget deal. Was there anything really good about it? Obviously, it keeps government open for a couple of years, right? That's a good thing. Other good things?
It does keep government open. And while we're likely to have another confrontation of some sort or another when the debt ceiling hits its limit in February, it appears as though this deal is likely to end this constant, you know, series of confrontations, cliffhanger moments, possible shutdowns for the next 2 years. I mean, that so if that's the case, that's a good thing because it means more time can go into real legislating and real budget making as opposed to these conflicts that basically get you through the moment but don't solve a problem. It's not the big grand bargain that people had talked about. I think we're still in a point where it's pretty difficult for the two sides to reach agreement on that. But it, you know, it was a small measure of bipartisan success, and it was engineered by Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray almost by themselves. I mean, they basically went into a room together and worked this out, but they were able to get a very strong vote in the House for it. And it appears that it'll pass the Senate. It'll probably be a little bit closer in the Senate, but it appears it'll pass.
And what does it do for the prospects for another run for national office for Paul Ryan?
Well, I mean, it's put him back in the headlines. And I think there's a question that everybody has who's watching this as to whether he sees his future as a presidential candidate or as a leader in the House in one place or another. And he hasn't answered that question yet, so we don't know. There is a recent poll that was just released in Iowa among Republicans, and Paul Ryan has the most favorable numbers of any Republican who's a prospective candidate in 2016 in that state. So you would have to say he's still popular with the Republican base, and if he chooses to run, he would be a formidable candidate.
Mm-hmm. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
So happy to be with you.
Dan Balz, author of Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America, chief correspondent at The Washington Post, former national editor, political editor, White House correspondent, also author of The Battle for America 2008. While we're talking politics, we want to remind you that Doris Kearns Goodwin is going to be with us tomorrow. Her latest book, I haven't finished it yet. It's really huge, but it's fabulous. The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. She will be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Molly Ball is with us now for the next part of All Things Political. She's a staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. She previously worked for Politico, where she covered the fight for the 2012 GOP nomination and the 2010 midterm elections and the national political landscape. She's worked for papers in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Cambodia, as well as the New York Times and the Washington Post. Molly, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you with us. Well, let's start with this budget deal. There are some who think, well, it's good because it's kept the government open for a couple years. Let's start with discussion about Paul Ryan, who you have said, I believe, is seen as something of a traitor to the cause for negotiating this bipartisan budget deal. But I'm sure that he's seen as a hero in other quarters for negotiating such a deal.
Yeah, I actually don't think that Paul Ryan is widely perceived as traitorous. I think, in fact, the degree to which Paul Ryan has, if you will, gotten away with this with the right, shows how much credibility he had with the conservative wing of the party. He did negotiate a deal that a lot of folks on the right are grumbling about. And there were a lot of votes against it by conservative Republicans in the House. But at the same time, you are not hearing him decried as a rhino all over talk radio. There's been a little of that, but remarkably little. And I think that is because he did have such a strong profile as a conservative going into this that he was able to bring those people along.
Mm-hmm. So the Republicans, you say that perhaps they've learned a major lesson from the shutdown.
Yeah, I think so. I think Republicans really touched the stove with that shutdown, and it didn't work out very well for them. And there was a real sort of shock to the system for a lot of conservatives that this is, especially in seeing how swiftly public opinion responded, how quickly Republicans' poll numbers tanked, and how terrible the backlash was against them in their own districts and across the country. There was a desire not to do that again. And there was also a feeling that the party is winning the argument on Obamacare, and it would be a shame to throw away that advantage by picking another fight that they probably couldn't win.
Mm-hmm. Are they winning the argument on Obamacare? Are they the favorite party right now?
Well, yes, in very literal terms. We always like to caveat, you know, polls more than a year in advance or less than a year in advance of a an election by saying they don't mean much, right? But the sort of the generic congressional ballot, which has been favoring Democrats literally all year up to this point, now favors the Republicans in a couple of different polls. The president's ratings are down. That doesn't really matter. He's not on the ballot. But a number of Democrats in red states are on their heels. The Senate is looking like it could even be up for grabs. Republicans look like they may gain rather than losing seats in the House. So by pretty much any measure, it does look like the Republicans have gained an electoral advantage as we have been debating Obamacare and as we have stopped debating the government shutdown.
Isn't it amazing how things happen so quickly? Because it wasn't that many months ago that the Republicans were blamed for shutting down the government and their approval ratings were in the tank. And now it's the Democrats and the president whose approval ratings, particularly the president, aren't faring very well at all.
Well, in a way, the shutdown was a blip, because the sort of trend all year was declining, eroding public confidence in Obama. If you remember, before the shutdown, we were talking about Syria, and that was a losing debate for the president, and that was one that had a lot of Democrats running for the exits, looking to separate themselves from a president whose proposed policy was extremely unpopular and who was not seen as having led effectively through that crisis. So I think you saw the shutdown made people rethink their opinion of Republicans. The current situation has caused a lot of people to turn against Democrats, not necessarily to go to the Republican camp. I think there are a lot of people sort of stuck in the middle, mad at both parties, mad at Washington generally.
Let me give just a brief description of the budget and tell me what you think is important, what you would add, and what is problematic. Finance, as we said, the government for the next 2 years, removing the threat of another government shutdown, boosting federal spending in fiscal 2014 by $45 billion, easing cuts to programs like Head Start, grants for low-income housing, reduced cost of living adjustments for military retirees, and not imposing any new cuts on Social Security or Medicare, but refusing to extend unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed. That's 1.3 million, at least, out of work. Those Americans will lose their benefits. Are there other major parts of this budget that we should pay attention to, and which of those are most important that I just outlined?
I think you hit all the important points. I would say that conservatives are most annoyed about the spending levels, the fact that this restores a lot of the sequestration cuts and sets spending at a level above where they would like to see it, and the fact that there are no long-term entitlement reforms. Besides the changes to military pensions, as you said, there's no changes to Social Security or Medicare. Liberals and Democrats are the most annoyed that some of the defense spending that some of them had welcomed in sequestration the cuts that some of them had welcomed will be restored. And most of all, that unemployment insurance was not extended in the deal. But Democrats still think that they may be able to win on that. And I am not sure whether they are hoping completely in vain or whether there actually is a chance of this, because they do see it as a winning political message, and they think that when they come back in January, they may be able to convince Republicans to extend that.
And what do you think? Do you think that's a possibility?
I really don't know. It has happened in the past, because it has been something that Republicans have not wanted to look insensitive. I think a lot of Republicans are resistant to it. And we're also going to have the debate over the farm bill, the debate over food stamps, which is sort of similar in terms of the political resonance. And so I really have no idea where that goes.
Molly, how do you explain the declining confidence in the president?
Well, I think it's a number of things. As I mentioned, I think the Syria debate dented him. And if you look at inside the polls, it was mostly with Democrats. I think there are other things that have caused members of his base to be really disillusioned with him. A lot of the hit Obama has taken has been with young people who may have had a lot of confidence in him in terms of helping him get reelected and then been disappointed by all the things that he hasn't been able to get done this year. The president started the year with a sort of very lofty agenda, fell short on things like gun control and immigration. The budget deal ended up getting done seemingly sort of in spite of him, so he has seemed to be a bystander in a lot of the things happening in Washington, D.C. And some of it may just be typical second-term blues where the president has a hard time remaining relevant.
Mm-hmm. Is it surprising that on the issue of immigration, which we heard, you know, not that many months ago, was an issue that it would behoove both the Democrats and the Republicans to move on immigration, the Republicans in their own self-interest would be better served to have some kind of immigration bill passed, and the Democrats have been wanting to do that for some time. Why couldn't there be any movement on that issue?
I do want to just go back to what I was just saying briefly, and I don't want to leave out Obamacare in explaining the president's dropping ratings, because obviously that has been a rocky rollout, and I think it's not just the fact that it hasn't gone as well as it could, but a lot of people have lost trust in the president because of that, have lost trust in his truthfulness in saying things that don't turn out to be untrue, and also in the administration's basic competence, which is a big deal and may not be reversible. To your question about immigration, I've written about this previously as a sort of case study in Washington dysfunction, because as you say, it is something that both parties seem to agree at the sort of establishment level is in their political best interest. Both parties would like to get this done for the business community. Both parties would like to get this done for the sake of appealing electorally to Latino and Asian voters, for whom it is a very important issue. And yet, for sort of inexplicable reasons, right, for reasons that nobody can quite explain, it hasn't gotten done. The Speaker of the House seems to favor it in concept, but not letting it happen in practice. And he still says that it might happen, but a lot of immigration activists have started to feel like they're being strung along and have started to lose faith in the constant promises that this is eventually going to happen. They sort of want to see some action from the congressional leaders who keep saying, okay, after this next thing.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Molly. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. Molly is a staff writer who covers national politics at The Atlantic, and she's been covering politics for quite a few years now for organizations other than The Atlantic, plus The Atlantic. We're talking about a number of issues. The budget, of course, there was an agreement. It's passed the House. It goes to the Senate. What do you think of Paul Ryan's skills in helping to fashion a bipartisan deal? What do you think of Speaker Boehner's blasting of outside groups who he said hadn't even read the bill before they were against it? What does it say about the power of those groups? The declining confidence in the president. How do you explain the declining confidence? Does it have a lot to do with the health care, which continues to have issues? And maybe some things aren't even directly connected to Obamacare, but premium increases, people are saying they blame on the Affordable Care Act. Well, why is it that we haven't been able to see any movement on immigration issues or on gun control issues? We certainly welcome your phone calls in the time that remains for All Things Political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, please leave messages there. We love to read them. Is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. It was my understanding that sequestration was supposed to cut across the board. I mean, it was supposed to hurt all of us. And I've always felt that way about whether we're fighting wars or whatever. Every American should feel the impact of whatever legislation. And it seemed months back, Congress people and some flyers of corporate jets realized that if we didn't have sufficient number of air traffic controllers, that there would be inconveniences. So then they started cutting back on the concept of across-the-board cuts. I'm wondering if your guest sees this also in terms of its sequestration is essentially dead as a concept, and now it's the Pentagon needs to get its billions of dollars, and Head Start shouldn't get too much money, and so on and so on. It really seems cynical to me. It really does.
Molly.
Never truly across the board. The cuts were to the Defense Department and to discretionary spending. Now, they were across the board in those two areas, but, you know, the vast majority of the federal budget is made up of spending on Social Security and Medicare, and those were not touched at all. So it was not an across-the-board cut to government spending overall. And, of course, there are a lot of areas of our lives that are not touched by the federal government. So if to the extent to which we don't, you know, interact with the Defense Department or interact with things like welfare programs, we wouldn't necessarily feel that. Now, a lot of people did see hypocrisy in the fact that Congress rushed to fix the air traffic control issue. Members of Congress, of course, take many flights.
Yes, they do.
A lot more than your average civilian. And so, you know, I think it is accurate to see that, you know, once it impacts them personally, they suddenly want to do something about it. And that, I think, has a lot to do with why people feel so frustrated about Washington politics. There's a feeling that lawmakers just don't care unless it affects them personally. But the things that other people are personally affected by somehow don't seem as urgent to them.
Thank you, Rich, very much for the call. Where are we going to see increased spending in defense? What more do we need to spend money on?
Well, the I cannot speak to the specifics of what the Pentagon is going to spend on. Most of the sequestration cuts had not actually gone into effect. Most of them were still in the coming calendar year.
Oh.
So the Pentagon has managed to, you know, they furloughed some workers. They did make some cuts here and there. There was a lot of sort of chest clutching and fainting among the Pentagon top brass about how this was going to hurt our military readiness. And to some lawmakers, that was very convincing. And to others, this was just these were necessary cuts and they were just whining. And I am not qualified to analyze whether our military readiness actually would have been harmed by these cuts. But that was certainly the claim by the Pentagon. Even those who wanted to cut defense spending, which includes some on the left and some on the right, generally said that these cuts could have been done more surgically, could have hit the actually wasteful parts,
right,
instead of the way sequestration did, which was just a hatchet across the board.
Yeah. And at the same time, they reduced the cost of living adjustments for military retirees.
That is correct. And the idea was, I think, that, and you do hear some senators saying that that's the reason they can't support this deal is because they don't like the idea of cutting benefits for military veterans. But I think part of the idea was that they were not likely to complain too much because what was being restored was a lot of the military spending. So the military had to take a smaller cut somewhere else to compensate for getting most of their money back.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, and this is All Things Political. You're listening to On the Ideas Network. Molly Ball is our guest, staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. Dee and Amory is next. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest, she listed a few things that Obama hadn't gotten done. I'd like to ask her how many of those things he could do by himself without cooperation from the House and the Senate and everybody else that's supposed to be cooperating.
Well, I would say, first of all, I don't think they're necessarily supposed to be cooperating. A lot of Republicans got elected precisely on a promise that they would not cooperate with the president, and they are keeping that promise. I was attempting to explain why the president's poll numbers have dropped, but I personally am not mad at the president. I'm just I'm objective here. But, you know, I do think that there is a feeling, however justified among the American public, that Obama's failure to get things done is somehow his fault. I think the Republicans are also blamed for that. They blame all of Washington for not being able to come together and get things done. And you know, Obama has pointed out many times that the Republicans will not let him get things done. And in his second term, we have seen him be a lot more assertive about trying to get these things done by himself where he can, taking executive actions, using the power of the federal agencies, particularly on the environment, to implement the changes that he's being blocked from achieving through the Congress.
When you think about Molly, it hasn't really been a great time for people of differing viewpoints to get together and come up with some kind of plan that will address the major issues of our time in a bipartisan fashion. It's really been pretty dismal in that regard, hasn't it?
Sure. I mean, one explanation for this is just that we are impossibly divided as a country. You know, the representatives that we have in Congress were put there by the American people, and some of the American people feel very strongly in one regard, and a lot of other Americans feel very strongly in another regard. And when those are sort of absolutely held beliefs, right, such as the belief that we must have more taxes and the belief that we must have less taxes, there isn't a middle ground there except the status quo. And so, you know, in a sense, this gridlock is just reflecting the sort of ideological gridlock that exists as a nation. People tend to want compromise in theory. They like the idea of lawmakers coming together and compromising, but they don't actually want the other side to win. They don't actually want their beliefs not to be implemented in full. And so it's very hard to find middle ground between irreconcilable positions.
Chris in McGuanago. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. I, too, wanted to ask an additional question about your take on the president's loss of popularity and loss of believability. Do Americans think that the drone policy and the drone strikes have had a negative effect that way on the president's popularity?
That's a very good question. And I have looked at a little bit of the polling on that. I think that was another instance where the president did lose some confidence from his base. There were a lot of liberals outraged over that action. Most Republicans who could be mad at the president are already mad at him. So he's not losing a lot of ground with Republicans these days. And even independents, I don't think, are particularly exercised over foreign policy. But that was an instance similar to Syria where it seemed like it was Democrats and liberal Democrats who were being turned off to the president.
Well, I know you've written about her, so I think we should talk about Hillary. How are things going for Hillary? How are the plans for her to conduct a big presidential campaign?
Well, I recently attended a fundraiser launch event in D.C. for the Ready for Hillary Super PAC, which is not in any way affiliated with Hillary Clinton, but is sort of a combination draft committee and political campaign in waiting for Hillary Clinton should she decide to run. This is not necessarily anything new. Plenty of times in the past there have been efforts to draft candidates into a presidential race and to show them that there is grassroots support for them. But there is a slightly surreal feeling to this essentially campaign committee being set up that has everything. You know, they've got a communications director, they've got fundraisers, they've got events across the country and a grassroots network. All they don't have is a candidate, because Hillary is still not saying whether she's going to run. And, you know, 3 years out, she doesn't necessarily have to. But there is certainly a desire, I think a desire among some Democrats, to move on from Obama and move on to something potentially more optimistic and hopeful, because it just a lot of people have made their minds up about Obama and feel like he is what he is, and the next thing is going to be the next thing. Mm-hmm. So I was surprised at the number of people that I spoke to at this Ready for Hillary fundraiser who were a little bit down on Obama, and either because they supported Hillary back in 2008 and feel like they were right all along, or because they liked Obama at one point but now are just ready to move on.
Mm-hmm. And what about Elizabeth Warren? What role is she going to play in helping define the issues?
Well, Elizabeth Warren has repeatedly said she's not going to run for president. Now, I've been reporting even back in late 2011 or early 2012, before the last presidential election, I attended a liberal group's event that where they had a straw poll and Elizabeth Warren won it. So before she was even elected to the Senate, Elizabeth Warren had a lot of support on the left. And so you do hear there is this common conception among progressive Democrats that Elizabeth Warren is their standard bearer in spirit, if not in practice, right? Even if she doesn't run for president, the idea is that she represents this vibrant new strain of economic populism that is going to inflect the party whether or not she is the person to carry that banner. And whoever the next nominee is, whether it's Hillary Clinton or somebody else, is going to have to respond to that desire within the grassroots. I am not sure how much of this is sort of a beltway phenomenon and how much of it is a real grassroots phenomenon. It has never been the case that the liberal grassroots has as much sway in the Democratic Party as the Tea Party does in the Republican Party. The parties are just structurally different that way. But it is certainly something that's getting a lot of attention right now, I think partly because things are not going well for Democrats. Things are not going well for the president. Things are not going well for Democrats in Congress. And so the party has sort of turned inwards and started bickering about a lot of the debates that Democrats tend to have. And this is one of them.
Mm-hmm. And she's also willing to take on institutions like big banks that nobody else seems to be willing to take on.
Right. That's what this sort of economic populism means. She is very aggressive against Wall Street, and she has really been a crusader since she got to Washington. She has given a lot of people tough grillings from her perch on the Senate Banking Committee, and she has not been shy about pressing this agenda. And so I think, you know, whether it's on the left or the right, people really respond to politicians who seem like they are speaking from conviction, politicians who seem like they really have a cause that they believe in and that are not just about sort of political triangulation and trying not to offend anybody. So she's really struck a chord, especially as, you know, the effects of the recession continue to be felt and people continue to feel a lot of economic anxiety. She definitely has struck a chord with people.
Mike in Franklin. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Molly. Hey, Molly, here's my question. I'm a blue-collar worker. I've been my whole life. And what I see is happening now is President Obama is trying to pursue some progressive initiatives. And with all the money, with just a few people on the right, and it's like our Republican leaders have sold out, Ryan and Scott Walker, to the moneyed interests. And it's like you can't. They're not listening to the average people. People, you know, people need decent jobs. We need health care. These are all things that need to be fixed. And it's like nobody wants to listen to what's really the most important thing in everyday Americans' lives. And it's health care, and it's decent jobs. And it's like we're being drowned out by the moneyed interests, and it's just not right. My vote or when I call Paul Ryan's office twice a month, I should get as much listening to and respect as if, you know, some big shot calls him up.
Molly.
I think the caller is absolutely expressing a frustration that a lot of people feel with the constant gridlock and bickering in Washington. Now, each party, of course, will say, oh, no, we're the ones who care about jobs and health care, and it's these other guys who just won't let us do what we want to do. But when both parties seem preoccupied with pointing fingers and with blaming the other side, it's hard for people not to just get tired of it all and turn away.
Thank you, Mike, so much for the call. Well, Molly, you were a great guest. I hope you'll join us again.
And oh, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for being with us.
I really appreciate it. It's always a great discussion.
Yeah. Thanks, Molly. Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. She's also worked for Politico, where she covered the 2012 Republican nomination and the 2010 midterm elections and the national political landscape, which is endlessly fascinating. Stay with us. Hour number two, Daniel Golden will be with us. Please get your pens and papers ready because he's a rapid fire book suggester. So you need to just have your pens and papers because he's going to be all over the place with wonderful recommendations for holiday giving and for just good reading over the holidays. The best books of 2013. I have my favorites as well. You have your favorites as well. So, Please stay with us. Actually, one of my favorites will be, I'm not finished with it, but Doris Kearns Goodwin, who will be joining us tomorrow at 2 o'clock. The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. It really is a fascinating book. Really good. So that will be our show tomorrow at 2. And we do want to tell you that, you know, everybody's talking about the Pope. How often do we talk about the Pope? We'll look at the Pope, Time Man of the Year, on Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the program and for on-air production. Thanks also to Lisa Nalbandian. We have news from National Public Radio coming up momentarily, and then we'll return and talk books. So stay with us on the Ideas Network.